This is a Chilkoot Charlie series written and read by Reuben Gaines, and there will be 6 stories. The first one, the bear. The second one, the baseball game. The third one, the drunken whale. The fourth one, the aurora. The fifth one, the mosquitoes. And the sixth one, the fountain of youth.
The tale is roughly titled Chilkoot Charlie and the Bear. How innocent that title sounds while sitting smugly there. Before we're halfway finished with our hero and his battles, we'll wail in anguish, one and all, like brats who've lost their rattles. The thing commences in a most deceptive, gentle vein. The cub, who shivered in the rain, took him to the cabin, where he fed him muskeg soup and bundled him in blankets so he wouldn't catch the croup. The mother bear doubtless passed away among the sticks, assisted by some lout who shot a 30.06. So Chilkoot nursed the waif with all the means he had at hand. There never was a more repulsive mother in the land. The spring and summer passed away. Autumn came in focus. The cub had grown to urchin size, and certain hocus pocus would greet old Chilkoot when he ambled in from all the traps. At times he thought he'd like to make a pair of grizzly shaps. The waif would knock the cans from all the cupboards and cavort in other ways of mischief, doing things he hadn't ordered. But urchins will be cubs, and Chilkoot Charlie didn't moan as long as Grizzly Jr. left his liquor stock alone. If Jr. had as much as pulled a cork from off a jug, the trapper would have had that very day a brand new rug. One day our hero went abroad to gaze upon his traps and gather in the mink, which make them $1,000 wraps. Before he left, he'd fixed a bed for Junior in the kitchen. He looked a little beat for hibernation he was itching. So then, when Chilkoot snowshoed back a week from when he'd started and looked inside, there came a roar from where his beard was parted. Young Junior's place beside the kitchen stove was bare. Instead, he hibernated happily in guess whose private bed. That there was quite enough. Old Chilkoot kicked him in the nether, but Junior didn't move. He only snored heck-bent for leather. And by now, his grizzly pal weighed, 900 pounds, I'd wager, and lay there smugly like a colonel. No, at least a major. To say the old man's rage was great would only be to trifle. He cussed a mighty oath, then he lifted up his rifle. Then Junior opened up one eye, and calmly, as you'd cough, reached out and grabbed old Chilkoot's gun, and while Chilkoot looked in horror at the stock within his hand, young Junior, with a grisly smile, returned to slumberland. What Chilkoot must have thought while stewing in his rocking chair and gazing at his bed, which now contained that thieving bear, better not be stated on a bridge, I rather think. The censor folks had pulled the plug and sent us down the drink. There's one thing sure. While Junior slept and Charlie meditated, the air around him grew so thick it felt like marinated. At last the old man's hand stole out, grabbed a two-blade axe. He rose and slithered like a snake across the floorboard cracks. But when he raised the axe to start the stroke that meant the end, young Junior opened up an eye which plainly said, "Why, friend." That's the way it went, so help me, right on through the season, till Chilkoot lost the bolts that held the hinges of his reason. Each solitary time that Chilkoot had her figured out, the bear would open up that eye and put the plan to rout. The rattled trapper gave it up. He settled in his chair and drank a jug of booze a day and gazed at that there bear. The spring rolled round. One day our hero awakened from a doze, and looking at the bed, he saw that Junior had arose. He shambled to the kitchen and was busy at the moment fomenting all the trouble it was possible to foment. Not only had he ate the grub while Chilkoot was in snooze, he'd pulled a couple corks and sat there soused on guess whose booze. The pain of that discovery unmanned our ancient buddy. Had Chilkoot weaker been, he would have wept the Chugach muddy. He only sighed a gusty sigh, whose tone was resignation, and then he mix some hotcakes to forget the situation. No sooner was he seated at the steaming hotcake stack when Chilkoot felt a nudging in the lumbar of his back. And there stood Junior, frowning. His expression said, "Say, Rover, you got no decent sense of hospitality. Move over." He guzzled Chilkoot's hotcakes while his host sat there bereft. From hence, this happened every meal. He ate what Junior left. The old man suffered through the spring, attending on young Junior, the situation grimly growing loonier and loonier. Although it's not a common trait for normal grizzly bears, this guest grew fond of Chilkoot's hoarded stock of fine cigars. When Chilkoot finished feeding him, young Junior settled back and gestured with his paw, took his snort of white and black. Then his host produced a light. This smug and shaggy Jonah would arrogantly fill the air with buck-a-piece Corona. His problem was a sticker, any imbecile would own. The old man had no weapon, and that Junior was full-grown. He never let the trapper get beyond suspicious sight. He followed on the trap line, he watched him through the night. Young Junior knew a good thing when he saw it, that's for sure. No other bear had ever had it quite so good before. He grew quite independent, too. This mattress-haired buffoon had learned to light his own cigars, just like a fat tycoon. So now we have made contact with the climax of the play. We lift the loving curtain on a certain night in May. The customary scene prevailed, with Junior fatly lounging, and poor bedraggled Chilkoot in the kitchen, sadly scrounging among the pots and pans and getting noticeably thinner, while cooking like a slave to get this lazy slug his dinner. He fried the customary sourdough hotcakes on the griddle, while Junior drooled and rubbed his big fat paws upon his middle. Without a decent grunt of thanks, when Chilkoot set the table, he licked the platter cleaner than a Derby winner's stable. While being served tray faithfully, the way the poet says, young Junior should have heard the click of empty cartridges. They clanked in Chilkoot's pocket as he shambled through the room and played a rattling prelude to the grizzly villain's doom. When Junior wrecked the rifle, he should never have forgot the bullets still were... Hold it, we'll decapitate the plot. The meal was done. The bear was full of hotcakes, had his booze, and now the fat cigar before his nightly one-eyed snooze. The bear bethought it strange. When Chilkoot offered him the stogie, he quickly turned and ran, just like a shark pursues a pogie. He scuttled through the door, barely paused to lift the latch. Young Junior shrugged in wonder, then he reached to get a match. When Chilkoot got, say, 30 yards beyond the cabin's rear, there came a great explosion, and it knocked him on his ear. He looked to see the joint go up in shambles through the air, then down again, with nothing left but sundry bits of bear. The old man started in to laugh. He chortled and he cackled. He giggled and he chuckled as the ruins burned and crackled. Though the rain began to fall, things were rather drizzly, he made a fricassee right there of late exploded grizzly. He wiped his chin, then took those empty bullets from his pocket and kissed each one. Looked as though his mind had sprung its sprocket. Without the powder in it, what's the value of a cartridge? It wouldn't shoot the feathers off a wooden-legged partridge. The powder's work was done. Old Chilkoot's laugh resounded far. Young Junior never should have lit that buck-a-piece cigar. The game of baseball was invented, some researchers say, in 1839 by General Abner Doubleday, while others claim the game stems from a far more ancient age. The pastime is as old, perhaps, as even Satchel Paige. In some state, Greece fought Troy because some sliding Trojan bird spiked good King Agamemnon as he barreled into third. That's really wandering far afield. There's one historic roamer who read it in a column by the baseball poet Homer. But those who study history with any zeal at all are well aware who fathered what is now the game of ball. In ages far removed, upon the tundras of the north, two giants passed the time by throwing mountains back and forth. It was Mordecai and Chilkoot, bearded characters uncouth who couldn't tell a lie because they never knew the truth. Detractors are inclined to sniff, An action strange and snide, considering the evidence is very hard to hide. This playing catch with mountains didn't mean a thing at first. Mere exercise, no doubt, to build a sweat and raise a thirst. Now and then, perhaps, a thieving scheme would thrive and grow while philosophically they heaved a glacier to and fro. In certain evil ways, this pair was twins, like Mike and Ike. But no two critters ever throw a missile quite alike. Old Chilkoot threw the fast one. It careened across the flats, the air behind it screeching like 100,000 cats. Conversely, six-toed Mordecai, when not too awful drunk, was more an ancient Eddie Lopat. Mordecai threw junk. He had a way of rearing back to let a mountain fly and chuckling, as it swerved, to smite old Chilkoot in the eye. When Mordecai's control was on, and so it was one day, he bounced a cliff off Chilkoot's head. It flew across the bay and came to rest as Mount Susitna. There she lies in state, a somewhat lopsided pile of rock from meeting Chilkoot's fate. Yes, boys will e'er be boys, as were these lively childish two. And history is numb with gratitude they never grew. Posterity, however, should in silence pass the hat and buy champagne and drink a thankful toast. The baseball bat, without which ball would perish, they invented. Most exalting to know the debt of gratitude that's owed by Mr. Spaulding. All contradictions will arise, but still the honest fact is, sans Mordecai and Chilkoot, there would be no batting practice. Old Chilkoot loved smoked mastodon. He chewed them as hors d'oeuvre while playing catch and waiting for friend Mordecai's next curve. One day, when Chilkoot held a piece of thigh bone in his hand, the pitcher Mordecai picked up and threw a piece of land. As Chilkoot ducked, the bone swung around. The pitch was hard and low, and the northern air was shattered by the force of Chilkoot's blow. The mountain struck the thigh bone, and as though it were alive, rebounded off the ear of Mordecai, the first line drive. It took no further prompting to such fertile minds as these to see the game of playing catch had possibilities. They quickly took their turns at batting fungos far and wide, and they really scrambled up the face of yonder countryside. It wasn't safe for birds to use the air those vivid days, and fish would cower neath the rocks for shelter in the bays. These incidents clear up a point that's often dwelt upon. What happened to the once unconquered race of mastodon? The answer is fairly obvious. The beasts died off like gnats until their thigh bones all were put to use as baseball bats. So, step by step, the game was born. They tired of hitting flies. They thought they should have certain rules and bases, otherwise the game might get monotonous. They set the infield bases 1,000 miles apart at four remote and far-flung places. The neighborhood of Barrow was decided on as first. The keg was placed there, naturally, in case of passing thirst. The region of the 40-mile was second. With a stick, they measured off third base, and that was down at Egigeek. The pitcher's mound was Fairbanks, what is now called Esther Dome. The backstop was Siberia, of course, since Nome was home. No grandstand then. When these two played themselves a game of ball, all creatures went for shelter, those that run or swim or crawl. Refinements came with passing time, and soon the style of play was very much the same as how the game is played today. But owing to the fact that people ran away to hide, the two were short of players, only one man on each side. That made no vital difference. We have a premonition you might object to hearing. Each played every position. But that's the gospel truth, for either Titan pitched and fielded, and they were mighty batsmen. When they hit one, something yielded. So that's the way it came about. Now the stage was set for something of a grudge game that entailed a mighty bet. In those days, there existed a curvaceous Amazon named Susie Flo, as fair as any ever looked upon. She kept these gnarled old Romeos on strings and tenter hooks, encouraging each one in turn with sizzling sidewise looks. Each figured her to be the Northland's finest nugget, so they bet whoever won the game won also Susie Flo. They tried to spit upon their hands at game time. No saliva. Their mouths went dry when thinking of this mountain-sized Godiva. Oh, that one was a fancy dish. But this is pure distraction. They made the bet, the stage was set, and all was ripe for action. No patron saw the game twixt Mordecai and Chilkoot Charlie, except for Susie Flo, who sat on top of Mount Denali. The contest was a dinger. Both possessed great stuff that day. They swung and missed so often that the weather people say the air was so disturbed, unless they're lying through the jaw, that they originated what is called the willow wall. And Susie Flo applauded fit to bust her backless gown as inning after inning each would mow the other down. Old Mordecai's control was something never duplicated, and Chilkoot whiffed in anger as the pitches dipped and faded. His knuckler in particular put Chilkoot on the rack. He swung and missed at least 2 miles and like to broke his back. But Chilkoot had his swift. He threw with mighty zeal and hate. The mountains that he pitched looked small as houses at the plate. As Susie waved her hanky, made of 7 hides of whale, each strove to smite the other, but the two could only flail. The batsman might have stood there at the platter with a shingle, for Susie Flo or no, he simply couldn't buy a bingo. The game went into extra innings, 9, 15, then 20. Though darkness would have fallen, in July there wasn't any. So on the game proceeded, 30 innings, 44, each batsman smiting but the breeze and coming back for more. The 49th went by, then 50, inning 62, and Susie rent the heavens with her delicate halloo. Came inning 86. In taverns, both these doughty yeomen were 86 so often that it should have been an omen. Well, that is when it happened. We beg you listen close. This here one has a climax that'll leave you comatose. As Chilkoot came to bat, old Mordecai's elastic flipper was still as strong as ever. Quick as swallowing a kipper, he fed 2 strikes to Chilkoot. As he swung, a wind went forth, blew up an ocean storm, and sank 2 whaling ships up north. Old Mordecai wound up. Behold, the moment that he wound, he heard a most distracting and unnerving kind of sound. Sweet Susie blew a kiss. It smote his ear with tender thud, a sound like herds of caribou proceeding through the mud. That second of distraction threw his rhythm off its stride. A gopher ball went sailing toward the plate, big, fat, and wide. He groaned a tune of anguish, later played on Nero's fiddle, and watched that pitch meandering directly down the middle. Old Chilkoot chuckled as he swung. Each muscle was behind it. He meant to send it forth where mortal man would never find it. The thigh bone met the mountain, and the impact was immense, as six-toed Mordecai turned round and sprinted for the fence, which was, of course, the Chugach range, the far-off right-field barrier, and Mordecai sped toward it like a frightened Irish terrier. As Susie Flo applauded, Chilkoot jogged around the bases, to barrel, drinking up the keg that held 100 cases, to second base, the 40-mile, to Egigik, that's third, and since his soul was soaring like a liberated bird, he slid to home, and therefore is attributed to him the groove that made the valley that contains the Kuskokwim. As Susie Flo came down from Mount Denali with a bound, the ears of both were stricken by a loud, demanding sound, and here came Mordecai, and in his gnarled, triumphant paw, he held the mountain that he'd pitched. The slack in Chilkoot's jaw grew wider, as he heard old Six-Toe swearing wide and high that he had caught the thing down near the Chugach on the fly. He grinned a snag-tooth grin he found impossible to hide and told old Chilkoot he was out. His catch retired the side. Though Chilkoot wasn't Socrates, he wasn't quite a goof. He stuck his nose in Six-Toe's face and hollered, "Where's the proof?" There were no witnesses, of course, and the argument became the birth of all the rhubarbs in the history of the game. The thunder that one hears in states that bound the Middle West are echoes of an argument that's never come to rest. For Mordecai and Chilkoot are still at it, it appears that this one won't be settled in 100,000 years. Susie wearied while they strove to wear each other's zeal off and wed the fish trap operator down around Kasilov. As one thing learned, however, since the day the game began, you never can depend upon a fickle baseball fan. One time, old Chilkoot took a fishing trip, the like of which will have you clutch your sides until you pop the final stitch. He really meant to hunt some walrus when he started out, but got entangled with a whale. Here's how it came about. He needed walrus hide to patch the roof upon his shack, and walrus skins are thickest in the bay near Kulukak. Well, Chilkoot slew a Chugach bear, pulled its canine tooth, which measured 7 feet, made a fine harpoon, forsooth. He crossed the range and headed down the mighty Kuskokwim, and on his back 2 kegs of booze. It was scarce enough for him, but Chilkoot figured he'd be back within a day or two. Besides, there wasn't room to pack both booze and walrus, too. He reached the bay, then waded out an inch above his socks and tarried till the walrus should appear among the rocks. While waiting, he uprooted him some trees and built a raft, then stashed the kegs of liquor and himself upon the craft and waited for developments, and soon they came about. Before he'd had a chance to spring the bung and wet his snout, he swore the biggest walrus in the world had come to view. He only saw the critter's back. Instinctively, he knew that this one was the one. He aimed and threw the great harpoon and hit the walrus square just like an Arctic Daniel Boone. We mean to tell the truth about the action that resulted. Let no one claim his gullibility has been insulted. The animal leaped high aloft, stood upon his tail, and Chilkoot saw he hadn't nailed a walrus, but a whale. We'd call the beast 150 feet at least in length. And Chilkoot clung to yonder harpoon rope with all his strength. The whale proceeded out to sea. The shores of the Kulukak were quickly out of sight, and man, there weren't no turning back. Now, Chilkoot Charlie, as you know, was not a timid soul, but still he had a fear of Hades. Shoveling that coal was sure to be the sentence that he'd get without a trial. For that, old Chilkoot wasn't ready, not for quite a while. The whale then gained momentum. As he switched from second gear, the raft, the booze, and Chilkoot flying closely in the rear. It only took a half a day to pass the Pribilofs while churning good old Bristol Bay to foaming briny troughs. The seals applauded with their flippers. Gave them quite a yak to see this first-hand evidence that Vaudeville was back. Well, suddenly the whale gave up. The pace wore out his nibs. He stopped so short that Chilkoot's raft collided with his ribs. Old Chilkoot shook in horror, like an early model Ford. The impact hurled a keg of precious liquor overboard. While Chilkoot grabbed the other one, in case it followed suit, the whale espied the first one. It opened up its snoot and gulped the keg on down like you and I would swallow scrapple, with hardly a contraction of its briny Adam's apple. You think that there was action up to now? Wait till we've checked the situation when that booze began to take effect. The whale's experience included everything but drinking. Didn't take a minute till the creature was, well, stinking. He hurtled and he twirled and slapped the water with his tail. One needn't strain too hard to visualize a plastered whale. No need to picture Chilkoot Charlie either, sprawling there and clinging to the raft with quite a case of mal de mer. But still he clung to yonder second keg like grimace death. The whale would have to fight for this one to his final breath. The mammal sounded to the depths, and when at last he rose, the better part of Bristol Bay filled Chilkoot's ears and nose. No matter what the antics of that ocean-going sot, old Chilkoot's arms around the keg were firm and yielded not. The mammal's tooth continued through the night till nearly noon, then its head began to swell, all same like big balloon. Its nose was hot. It wouldn't spout the customary stream. It snorted, but it didn't generate a thing but steam. No other explanation than our blubbery boy rover was undeniably and inconsolably hungover. The situation stood as just exactly what you think. That ocean-going sow's hound needed one more keg to drink. He turned his red-rimmed eye around and gazed at Chilkoot Charlie, who trembled on the raft like wind proceeding through the barley. Our friend was well aware what sort of thoughts the mammal had. The current outlook was, the way the French would say, très sad. What use was there to cut the rope and float upon the ocean? The whale could grab that keg plumb any time he took the notion. There ain't no use pretending. Just one flip of yonder tail and Chilkoot would be airborne, like the Manly Hot Springs mail. And then the beast could drink the keg of liquor at his leisure. The thing was near enough to give a man a case of seizure. The whale was bound to do it. Chilkoot hoped he'd make it quick. But still it swam around him, half in menace and half sick. And then kind fate stepped in, as it is often wont to do. Old Chilkoot felt firm ground beneath his mucklucks. Sacre bleu. The raft was resting on a rock, and lo, the tide was falling. Our hero hoped with all his soul that whale would keep on stalling. It did. Its muddled brain refused to grasp the case at hand, while Chilkoot rolled the keg from off the raft and onto land. The tide went out. Our hero sat in safety on the rock. The whale was out of reach and realized it with a shock. He flippered with his flappers and he flappered with his flippers. His roars of rage were heard 1,000 miles by anxious skippers. The old Chilkoot fondly laid his head against the keg of booze and spread himself across the rocks exhausted for a snooze. The bellows of the sea beast were as music to his ears, like a cradle song by Brahms or other lullabies one hears. No sense in dragging out this sinful thing, our man slept in. When he woke, the waters were around his frozen chin. He made the air a cobalt blue with blasphemy that day, as anyone would doubtless do neck deep in Bristol Bay. But being cold was just a starter. There was worse to bear. That cake of comfort let us face the case. It wasn't there. While Chilkoot slept, the tide rose up. How often fate must titter. And took the keg right out and handed it to yonder critter. Must have been the case, because Chilkoot heard with sinking spirit the mammal out there hiccuping till Davy Jones could hear it. The second bender that he threw was wilder than the first, out there somewhere west of Suez where a whale can raise a thirst. Our hero stood in water with his palate dry as dust while listening to that whale cavort, and man, how Chilkoot cussed. Kindly thing to do right here is give the man a hand, but Chilkoot Charlie never had it coming. Let him stand. We're far more interested in what became of that there whale. Some Eskimos in kayaks chanced upon his drunken trail and tracked him round the bay until they reached the Bering portal, the first time they had ever known an Arctic whale to chortle. They chased the wobbly mammal north and speared him. We regret that when the potlatch started and the whale was getting et, that alcoholic blubber was the plain and simple reason the village stayed polluted for the whole dad-ratted season. For instance, science holds this single critter, gnarled and callous, responsible for starting the Aurora Borealis. To state such loveliness could stem from him would be to say that maybe Yogi Berra had invented the ballet. The scientist who made this startling claim passed on last week, so there's no way of knowing if his tongue was in his cheek. In generations past, there lived a similar old titan named Six-Toed Mordecai, an ogre that would frighten the freckles off a copper bust of Huckleberry Finn, old Nick's direct descendant. Somewhat uglier than sin. He ran a raucous tavern where the bibulous foregathered, and every night the citizens got botched, completely lathered. This Mordecai resided in Casilo off on the coast, which had the reputation of a heck on earth almost. There dwelt a tribe of Indians, the northern branch of Tlinkets, and Six-Toe with his crooked dice relieved them of their trinkets while waiting for the spring, when from the north, the west, and east, the trappers came to town befurred, and they were likewise fleeced. The rivalry twixt Mordecai and Chilkoot, were informed, was fortunate. If they'd been friends, the corporation formed would sure have been a partnership unbearable and heinous. The stench of its corruption would have reached the planet Venus. But as it was, they waited for each other's final burying, a detestation most heroic. It was pure Wagnerian. There also dwelt in those confines a certain lovely maiden, if so she can be called, this female dearly fancied wading through Bristol Bay to Kodiak while humming languid airs. While other maids picked berries, this one went there picking bears. Old Mordecai and Chilkoot off were rivals for the women. But from the time they first espied this lovely creature swimming between a Fognack Island and the southern Kuskokwim, each Romeo determined that this there was made for him. Her name was graceful as her form itself, Susitna Susie, and each informed her of his love in accents low and boozy. Although her figure in the normal sense was rather burly, the copper of her hair fell down in ringlets crisp and curly. Susitna Susie, as we say, was somewhat Amazonian, yet made one think of rebels in the era Babylonian. Old Sixto brought her otter skins, and Chilkoot brought her beaver, their rival passion thick enough to whittle with a cleaver. The one gave nuggets big as eggs, the other big as boulders, until the weight of all his loot put cricks in Susie's shoulders. She had to make her choice at last, and Chilkoot was her pick. Although for either Romeo she didn't care a lick, some logic told her Chilkoot was the lesser of the evil. He grinned in satisfaction, like a cotton-guzzling weevil, while Sixto's broken-hearted tears bedewed his ugly mug. A sadness so intense he could scarcely lift a jug. To watch old Chilkoot mooning would have made you awful sad, since Susie only meant to dig the dolt for all he had. This Jezebel blinked shyly neath her 50-acre lashes, while ermine hides and nuggets filled her cabins and her caches. You wouldn't know the groom-elect, his manner started changing. And that for Chilkoot Charlie took a bit of rearranging. His bottled spirits intake dropped to 20 jugs per diem. It made his old seal-off cronies thirsty just to see him. He trimmed his beard, combed his hair, and even took a bath.
When Chilkoot Charlie is talked about, on truth there's open season. The feats that are alleged to him make liar out of reason. For instance, science holds this single critter, gnarled and callous, responsible for starting the Aurora Borealis. To state such loveliness could stem from him would be to say that maybe Yogi Berra had invented the ballet. The scientist who made this startling claim passed on last week, so there's no way of knowing if his tongue was in his cheek. In generations past, there lived a similar old titan named Six-Toed Mordecai, an ogre that would frighten the freckles off a copper bust of Huckleberry Finn, old Nick's direct descendant, somewhat uglier than sin. He ran a raucous tavern where the bibulous foregathered, and every night the citizens got botched, completely lathered. This Mordecai resided in Casilo off on the coast, which had the reputation of a heck on earth almost. There dwelt a tribe of Indians, the northern branch of Tlinkets, and Six-Toe with his crooked dice relieved them of their trinkets while waiting for the spring, when from the north, the west, and east, the trappers came to town beferred, and they were likewise fleeced. The rivalry twixt Mordecai and Chilkoot, were informed, was fortunate. If they'd been friends, the corporation formed would sure have been a partnership unbearable and heinous. The stench of its corruption would have reached the planet Venus. But as it was, they waited for each other's final burying, a detestation most heroic. It was pure Wagnerian. There also dwelt in those confines a certain lovely maiden, if so she can be called, this female dearly fancied wading through Bristol Bay to Kodiak, while humming languid airs. While other maids picked berries, this one went there picking bears. Old Mordecai and Chilkoot oft were rivals for the women. But from the time they first espied this lovely creature swimming between a Fognack Island and the southern Kuskokwim, each Romeo determined that this there was made for him. Her name was graceful as her form itself, Susitna Susie, and each informed her of his love, in accents low and boozy. Although her figure, in the normal sense, was rather burly, the copper of her hair fell down in ringlets crisp and curly. Susitna Susie, as we say, was somewhat Amazonian, yet made one think of rebels in the era Babylonian. The old Six-Toe brought her otter skins, and Chilkoot brought her beaver, their rival passion thick enough to whittle with a cleaver. The one gave nuggets big as eggs, the other big as boulders, until the weight of all his loot put cricks in Susie's shoulders. She had to make her choice at last, and Chilkoot was her pick. Although for either Romeo she didn't care a lick, some logic told her Chilkoot was the lesser of the evil. He grinned in satisfaction, like a cotton-guzzling weevil, while Six-Toe's broken-hearted tears bedewed his ugly mug. A sadness so intense, you could scarcely lift a jug. To watch old Chilkoot mooning would have made you awful sad, since Susie only meant to dig the dolt for all he had. This Jezebel blinked shyly neath her 50-acre lashes, while ermine hides and nuggets filled her cabins and her caches. You wouldn't know the groom-elect, his manner started changing. And that for Chilkoot Charlie took a bit of rearranging. His bottled spirits intake dropped to 20 jugs per diem and made his old Kasiloff cronies thirsty just to see him. He trimmed his beard and combed his hair and even took a bath, developments that would have shocked the Philistines aghast. And all the while that Susie was establishing her trousseau, "Go get me nuggets," she would murmur, and lover boy would do so. The wedding day drew nigh. Chilkoot stayed most shocking sober, and Susie set the happy nuptial hour, half past October. Then Six-Toed Mordecai arose from out of his despond and told old Chilkoot Charlie in a voice most strange and fond that such a prize as Susie, if the thing were done up brown, deserved a heretofore unprecedented wedding gown. He knew, quoth Mordecai, where mink grew big as whaling ships. And as a longing smile besmirked Susitna Susie's lips, he rhapsodized on how she'd look. Gad, how the bride would slink with low-cut, skin-tight splendor in a single hide of mink. The critters grew near Shungnak in the Kobuk watershed. Their hides were prime right now. The groom had best get out the lead and travel north before the snow descended on the moor. The look on Susie's face told Chilkoot he'd better do her. He shook the hand of Mordecai, his fervor rising high, and felt a pang at how he'd oft misjudged this sterling guy. He hugged his bride-to-be, and as she strangled in his beard, he told her he'd be back, that she shouldn't be afeard. For when half-past October smiled upon their wedding bower, she'd be beminked. He'd think of Susie hourly on the hour. With that, he strapped his mucklucks on and strode into the west, and happy beat the heart beneath his ribs, beneath his vest. Old Chilkoot angled north, where Kuskokwim and Yukon link, and thought of nothing but them ever-loving King's Eyes mink. He reached the Kobuk in a week or so, looked around. Now trappers know that mink are thick as locusts on the ground within the Kobuk meadows, but though Chilkoot searched with vigor, those mink were merely mink size, and they weren't any bigger. The natives hadn't seen no giant weasel folk about. A month went by, and Chilkoot felt suspicious of a doubt. He'd covered every inch twixt Anaktuvik and the Bering, and Chilkoot Charlie smelled a rat, which smelled in turn like herring. The snow began to fall. He felt a sudden stab of fear. His watch said half past August, must be later in the year. Then the thought descended like a bombshell from the Blitz, that no good Mordecai had put his timepiece on the Fritz. Old Chilkoot held it to his ear, heard neither tick nor tock, and knew that in more ways than one that fiend had stopped his clock. Forthwith he started running. The speed of Chilkoot's movement went down in history. There were no room for no improvement. The trappers wondered what typhoon the heavenly host had sent him, as Chilkoot crossed the Kobuk tundra gathering momentum. He picked him up and laid him down o'er stretches rough and level as though he were pursued by that Olympic star of the devil. As Chilkoot fled through Kotzebue, the natives of that town were flattened by the wind. Their shacks and tents were all blown down. By now his steam was up. By the time he reached McGrath, the people heard him coming and they skittered from his path. He overcame the speed of sound, then the speed of light. He left a comet tail behind while streaking through the night. By meteors, the north horizon often is begirt, but Chilkoot left him in his backwash like a dirty shirt. Meantime, in Kasilof, as the nuptial hour drew nigh, the wedding march was sounded and the groom was Mordecai. The hypocrite had told the bride that Chilkoot had deserted. She had the wedding license changed with Sixto's name inserted. The preacher said the magic words that made them wife and man, and ere the toasts were drunk and kissing of the bride began, a shriek was heard across the sky, a ghostly siren wailing. Old Chilkoot Charlie came in view, a roaring and a flailing. He dug his heels into the turf as though to pull the brake, and dug a pit which later on was christened Kenai Lake. Old Chilkoot somersaulted, landing head first in the hill. If some natives hadn't dug him out, he'd be there still. It took him quite a while, till about November noon. By that time, Sixto and the bride were on their honeymoon. Doesn't really matter now, but nonetheless, we feel we should report that Sixto got the bad end of the deal. Sweet Susie took to winking at the boys behind his back, ultimately left him holding nothing but the sack. And what about the great Aurora Borealis, pray? Seems obvious enough. Right on down to this here day, the backwash of the comet that was Chilkoot each October makes tracks across the sky, and you can see it when you're sober. The Chugach Mountains top them all in towering silhouette, and even those who know the land ain't sure how high they get. They stretch from St. Elias to the fringe of the interior, make the other mountain heights look shamefully inferior. Some undiscovered Chugach peaks make high Tibet look flat, and liken Mount McKinley to a pimple on a gnat. The air up there where Chilkoot scraped the belly of the moon was thinner than a highball in an Anchorage saloon. To such a region, you can bet your gold fiddle lower denture, no soul but Chilkoot Charlie ever dared to venture. He conquered each vicissitude that history can mention by calling on his legendary powers of invention. For instance, as the farmers keep a herd of cattle stock, this opportunist kept corralled a vast mosquito flock. One finds mosquitoes everywhere. Some are mighty sizable. But Chilkoot raised a species that were nigh unrecognizable, a corkscrew beaked creation with an outboard motored rear, the kind you see when someone flips a Mickey in your beer. According to the anglers who go fishing in the region, these insects still abound, and faith, their multitudes are legion. The modern type mosquito, though, just a little fella, although his wing spread still can span an average umbrella. In Chilkoot's time is when mosquitoes really had their growth, the size of either blimps or helicopters, and maybe both. Historians reveal, thereby earn our gratitude, that once mosquitoes had a very friendly attitude. Just like the horse assists the farmer with his plow and wagons, old Chilkoot taught his flock of happy-dispositioned dragons to screw their beaks into the ground to dig the holes for planting. Likewise, harvest spuds and turnips. It was most enchanting to watch the vast mosquito herd as patiently they dug while Chilkoot sat in comfort nipping blithely at his jug. Old Chilkoot taught them many things. He broke them to the saddle, whereas before he had to go snowshoe or by paddle, he chose a fast mosquito, put a saddle on its hind, and off would go his craft like it had just been turpentine. As they flew, the outboard on its tail with purr contented, while people down below looked up and swore they were demented. It raised a fair commotion when they landed in a town. The drunks would stare in unbelief. They'd lay their money down and wager they were seeing things. The history books allege that every lush who saw the sight went out and took the pledge. It was after such a pleasure cruise, while coming into land, old Chilkoot saw a thing below he couldn't understand. The middle of his garden was a gooey, slimy mess. What had brang the thing about, he couldn't even guess. He circled in astonishment, made him nothing wiser, to notice in the middle of the muck there sprang a geyser. Then there came the flash that made his brain pan fairly boil. While digging for potatoes, them mosquitoes, they'd found oil. As Chilkoot taxied in, he belted out a loud halloo that split the eardrums of walrus out near Kotzebue. And since for profit Chilkoot had a natural proclivity, the action round about the place was one of sheer activity. He transferred operations from the carrots and the peas and sharpened them mosquitoes' beaks for felling cedar trees. So ere the week was out, the derricks rose. One heard the hum of laboring mosquitoes drilling for petroleum. While Chilkoot rubbed his hands with glee and chortled like a miser, them insects kept on turning up with geyser after geyser. And as the days went on, the pile of barrels grew and grew. The whole dang mountain seemed to float in money-making goo. While Chilkoot sat in comfort, pouring whiskey in his craw, the insects did the work. He didn't have to lift a paw. When things were going nicely, all the barrels full of oil, an incident occurred that made a matter in the boil. Instead of sounds of derricks plunging, there was deepest quiet. The situation was so strange, he staggered out to eye it. And lying round about, amid the tundra and the brush, that mob of insects wallowed in a state of fearsome lush. Though Chilkoot probed the mystery with all of his cunning vigor, where they had got the alcohol was mighty hard to figure. But there they lay, passed out, limp. One of them would hiccup and search about with reddened eye to find himself a pickup. Old Chilkoot watched the drunk mosquitoes, to the wondrous puzzle to see a thirsty insect thrust his liquor-seeking muzzle as deep as possible into the ground, and then he'd weave back to his sleeping place as drunk as sin again. The mystery solved itself. All you who are informed have read that once the Chugach was a region tropic-warmed. Bananas grew, and oranges, other types of fruit, abounded in its fern-like trees, and coconuts to boot. Well, came the glacial age, and when the ice came on apace, why, all the fruits were buried underneath this selfsame place. Wouldn't take no brains. In fact, a man could be demented, and still he'd realize them tons of fruit were all fermented. So when the insects dug for oil, they'd run across this cache of subterranean 100-proof 10-million-year-old mash. And once they'd had a snort of this and got their senses numb, no wonder they lost their taste for rank petroleum. No matter how old Chilkoot urged and pleaded, swore and threatened, they'd stagger to the glory hole to get their whistles wetted. The thing became a nightmare. Drunk mosquitoes reeling round, singing barroom ballads and collapsing on the ground, making wobbly flights, off colliding in midair. His hair was pure enough to make a critter tear his hair. They took to rolling barrels off the mountaintops and shouted with happy insect glee to see the oil go pouring out. As Chilkoot's profits went to pot, his erstwhile slaves got poached, and as disaster flourished, he just sat and glumly watched. But there's an end to everything. All liquor stocks go dry, and that's what came of them fermented juices by and by. One morning, as they gathered at the glory hole to drink, and none of them were what you'd call exactly in the pink, they dipped their beaks into the ground and found, unhappy day, that all this wonderful ferment had melted plumb away. To take a drunk from off his booze, sans prelude or fair warning, is tough, to say the very least, especially in the morning. The old Chilkoot rubbed it in, of course. He grinned in satisfaction, assuming them mosquitoes would return to drilling action. But they had gathered in a knot. Chilkoot's grim surprise, they sat and stared at him with baleful, unforgiving eyes. The act went on for days. Each time the trapper took a nip, the dry mosquitoes drooled in hate and gave the man the pip. One night, as Chilkoot lay in bed, a pounding of his ear, the insects rose en masse, made their foul intentions clear. They crept upon his liquor stock the way a sneak thief burgles, and soon the air was filled with popping corks and thirsty gurgles. When Chilkoot rose next morn, he blew his alcoholic top, for in the night they drained the jugs of every living drop. He lived through many tragic days, but this, without dissension, was certainly the worst, to the one he never cared to mention. You'd think the man had had it all, but there was worse to come. Who knows what nasty thoughts in heads of drunken insects hung? The revelry was over, and the mob was spitting cotton, when one of them divulged a thought, the best he'd ever gotten. An insect or a man alike, when he's athirst for booze, will go where whiskey is. It was natural they'd choose to light on Chilkoot Charlie. Required no mental pains to realize pure alcohol was flowing into his veins. The old Chilkoot read their minds. As the insects made a rush, he turned in livid panic and he scuttled through the brush. The rest of this is tragical, but finish it we must. Who e'er escapes mosquitoes when they're filled with bloody lust? They caught him halfway up a tree and sunk their drilling gear into his boozy hide, and the man was bloodless for a year. They passed their inclinations to their offspring. It's no gag. Mosquitoes still drill human beings looking for a jag. But when they dined on Chilkoot, rest assured upon the spot, it was the very drunkest them mosquitoes ever got. It's oft occurred to us a certain theme the reader finds repeats itself throughout these Chilkoot tales. It winds, unwinds, disappears, and reappears, this never-ending theme. It rides above the drama like the milk is topped by cream. You'd call this theme the headline of the Chilkoot Charlie news. Stated in a single word, five letters, it spells booze. Wherever Chilkoot went, his close companion was a jug. It underlies his movements like a never-wearing rug. We'll give it to you straight. It sounds like such unvarnished guff. Here goes, old Chilkoot Charlie done discovered that there stuff. We'll grant you your astonishment. That once back in the past, a human never knew the vice of getting parched or gassed. That people went through dreary life expectorating cotton. Then Chilkoot came. That's when Denmark started smelling rotten. The names are so synonymous of Chilkoot and of liquor that none among the students of the past will carp or bicker. We're all agreed that Chilkoot started drunkards toward the sewer, and now let's tell the answer to the question, how'd he do her? The story goes way back to when Alaska was the tropics, which students of the past will read, unless they're all myopics. The Chugach Range was then a steaming valley, lush with palms, no animals. A trapper would have had to beg for alms. One day, old Chilkoot Charlie, sober, clear-eyed, clean of limb, such terms are so ridiculous when they're applied to him, went wandering across the tropic jungle for a lark. The parakeets were screeching like the fans at Fenway Park. And snake folks wound and undulated through the orchid trees. Life was simply lousy with contentment, peace, and ease. By then, already Chilkoot was 100 years of age. The birds and reptiles knew him as a kind and gentle sage. Well, even back in tropic times, this bearded one of old would prospect, not for silver, copper, marten hides, or gold. His quest was for what all ancients hoped to find, forsooth, that clear, that sparkling, bubbling fountain of eternal youth. It was long before old Ponce de Leon was moved to go to Florida to find his special brand of H2O. Friend Chilkoot was the first to set upon this venture risky, for waters that would keep a man perpetually frisky. He wandered far afield from what was then his Chugach home and found a green oasis, which was later known as Nome. He'd covered 700 miles, this ancient, worn, and stooped. He was justified in feeling somewhat ouskypoop. He laid him down beneath a palm, his head upon a hummock, and as he slept, a parrot laid an orchid on his stomach. Yes, peaceful was his sleep, for Chilkoot was a righteous sort. Okay, now let us finish here. You take this thing to court. While sleeping came a vision, came an angel, slim and fair, whose voice was like a perfumed zephyr zephing through his hair. It bade him rise and follow, did this babe. It was a babe. Her figure would have turned the righteous head of honest Abe. But Chilkoot wouldn't know about such things. His toes obediently bore him through the rhododendron rose, behind the comely maiden. By a spring she bade him stop. It bubbled, did this spring, like 7 bars of Harlem Bop. He gazed into its depth, and in a voice that shook with truth, the angel told him that he'd found the fountain, yes, of youth. A surge of grateful awe encompassed him from toe to hair. But as he bent to drink, her voice said, "Wait, desist, forbear." She told him then, before he drank, that he must keep in mind that he should never tell this thing to others of his kind. No other man but Chilkoot, for the others were uncouth, must ever know a thing about this fountain here of youth. He promised he would never tell, bent to take a sip, and straightway what a smile of pure contentment curved his lip. He looked with new approval at the chaste angelic gal as sunshine spread through Chilkoot's alimentary canal. Already he could feel the glow of fast-returning vigor, and Chilkoot concentrated on the angel's lissom figure. But even while he gazed, before his thoughts could even gel, the angel disappeared with these 2 final words, "Don't tell." Well, as we say, old Chilkoot was a man of moderation. He took another tiny sip to taste this new sensation and stood to scratch his scalp. Praise be, a thatch of hair it grew. The thing had been as smooth as Harding Lake where folks canoe. He felt his chin. His beard was disappearing, he could see. Instead of 105 years old, he felt, say, 53. His arteries were softening. He heard them twang and stretch. One could near forgive the man for shotishing a titch. At night he dreamed the youthful dreams he hadn't dreamt for years. But when an angel disappears, she really disappears. That's beside the point. He knew he had his youth again. And time was moving backward, like a wrong-way pocket bend. Next day, in skittish mood, he plumb forgot his moderation. The way he drank that water was a shameless dissipation. When young, men got no use for that there moderation guff. It's only gaffers who are wise to when they've had enough. So Chilkoot got a noseful. When noon was in the heaven, our hero had reduced his age to maybe 37. And still, no matter how he concentrated with a vim, that angel must have known and never reappeared to him. He simply hollered, "Timber," and when sunset glowed like wine, old Chilkoot was aware that he was only 29. He took an extra snort and went to sleep. Strike dumb our throat if Chilkoot, when he woke again, was old enough to vote. That was when it happened. It was a shocking thing indeed for Chilkoot to discover he possessed a native greed. There came to him an evil thought. It was scarcely Aristotle's. It was more like Lucifer's, thought he. "I'll put the stuff in bottles and sell it. Yes, I will, dad rat my rotten, nasty hide, and I'll collect for sure a fortune from the folks outside." He plumb forgot the angel's warning when the greed o'ertook him. His conscience was a goose, and Chilkoot settled down to cook him. No sooner said than did. He took some bottles and some kegs and filled them full of magic water, drained it to the dregs, made a dozen trips outside. It sold and sold and sold to citizens whose bunions told him they were growing old. He gave the stuff a catchy name. He figured he would choose a word both short and interesting. He called it simply booze. Ere long, friend Chilkoot Charlie was the richest man since Croesus. He owned the public lands and on the rest of them had leases. The palaces he lived in were constructed of pure platinum, with Davenport so soft you sank from sight whene'er you sat in them. But wait before you join old Chilkoot Charlie in rejoicing and see how all this opulence turned out to be pure poison. When Chilkoot took the waters from the spring, how fate is fickle, the real estate around it froze just like a great popsicle. Bedad, it kept on freezing. It was like you've seen it since. In 9 months a year, it's cold enough to pucker up a quince. But Chilkoot didn't mind a bit. He lived down south in splendor, conducting with his worthless cronies one long, endless bender. And one grim day, it was grim, dear friend and gentle hearer, he had some slaves of his erect a huge and spotless mirror. He took a single look and turned bright green around the gills to see he wasn't young. In fact, he was older than the hills. His grayish beard was growing in. The pouches neath his eyes were big enough to hold the U.S. mail. His neckband size had shrunk until his mottled skin was like an alligator, his Adam's apple undulating like an elevator. This should be horrible enough, but hold, that wasn't all. He heard a vast commotion and a cursing in the hall. A mob of citizens were there. They broke the gateway down and tarred and feathered Chilkoot, and they rode him out of town. Our hero was too terrified to understand the reason, although he heard such words as fraud and gyp, fake, and treason. Recall the angel's warning? It was a shame that Chilkoot told. The stuff don't make you young no more. Makes you old.
This is the end of this tape. The rest of it is bare.